This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who is brought to you by the Amazon Store. Click on the link on our website before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show. These are The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 4.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years. I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush. Welcome back to this new episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who, dedicated to Season 8 or Series 8 of this incredible series that has conquered the world, and millions of people are tuning in every week to watch these new adventures of this new Scottish Doctor who has a lot to complain. I didn't have too much to complain about this episode. I liked it a lot. Joining me to discuss the episode called Listen are my good friends Jimmy Akin and Dom Bettinelli. Good morning or good afternoon or evening. I don't know what kind of time zone / universe you guys live.
It's morning in my universe.
It's afternoon at the end of the universe.
And just in time for tea
evening,
time at the
evening here in the Netherlands. So it's always tea time, right?
Yeah.
So today we're going to talk about the episode Listen, kind of a different genre compared to the first three episodes of this season. A bit of a scary story. Also looked a bit low budget in terms of special effects, but we'll talk about that. But let me first ask you, Jimmy, if you could recap the episode right after I play the next time trailer sound.
What's that? In the mirror, or the corner of your eye. What's that footstep following? Never passing by. Perhaps they're all just waiting. Perhaps when we're all dead, out they'll come a slithering from underneath the bed.
And that was the preview. So what have we been looking at?
Well, in this episode, the Doctor has a wild idea that he actually kind of becomes obsessed with. And the idea is that there could be a creature that has been evolved to be the perfect at hiding. Whereas some creatures are really good at hunting or really good at defending themselves, he has the idea there could be a creature that has evolved to be so good at hiding that we're never aware of it. And in fact, when we're talking to ourselves, when we think we're alone, we actually on some subconscious level realize we're not alone. And so we're talking to these hidden companions all around us. And he decides to try to prove that. He goes to get Clara, and Clara has just been having her first date with Danny Pink. And it goes horribly wrong, and she storms out. And so she's feeling bad. The Doctor shows up and wants her to go on an adventure with him. She kind of reluctantly goes along. And he explains that he has this theory that at some point in their lives, everyone in the universe has the same dream. And the dream is one that there's something under your bed, and then when you get out of your bed, something like grabs your foot. And so what he proposes to do is to take Clara back to the moment in her history where she had this dream, so they can investigate and find out, like, was the thing under her bed one of these hidden invisible companions? And so he hooks her into the telepathic circuits of the TARDIS, which in this episode look rather like the surface of a glowing brain, and she puts her fingers in there. And they set off through the time continuum to her childhood. But as that's happening, she gets a phone call from Danny Pink, and she's so rattled by that that they end up being diverted into the moment in Danny Pink's childhood where he had this same dream. And so the two of them end up visiting him in a children's home, and we find out that his original name was Rupert and that he was very scared. And we sort of see something under a bed cover that might be a hidden companion or that might just be another child playing a joke on Danny. But it's a rather tense scene where the Doctor gives Danny a speech about being afraid and how it's okay to be afraid because it gives you, in essence, a superpower. You can, with all the adrenaline, you can run faster, you can leap higher, you can think quicker. And so fear can actually be a good thing. And they then all turn their backs on the thing on the bed and promise not to look at it if that's what it wants. And it leaves in a rather dramatic way. And we're never really given clarity about whether it was just a child under a bedspread or whether it was some kind of super evolved hidden companion. After the encounter with Danny – oh, and one thing during the encounter with Danny, Clara – gets a box of toy soldiers and puts them around Danny's bed saying they're going to guard it. And there's one particular toy soldier that she identifies as the boss. And this one has no gun. It's broken. And so she says, well, of course it doesn't need a gun. It's such a great leader that he doesn't even need a gun. And what shall we call it? And Rupert immediately proposed calling it Dan. And so we get a hint of his future name. After this encounter with the young Danny, Clara asks the doctor to return her to her date with the adult Danny so she can make things good since she stormed out previously. And they start to do that, but then things start going wrong. And she sees a man in an orange spacesuit enter the back of the bar, and her conversation with Danny is becoming uncomfortable again, and he ends up storming out on her. She then goes back to the kitchen where she saw the man in the orange spacesuit and thought it was the doctor and is berating him when he takes his helmet off, and it turns out to look very much like an older version of Danny. And the doctor appears and explains that this is someone from her future, someone connected with her personal timeline about 100 years from now. His name is Orson Pink. And maybe he's a relative of hers. And we're given later in the episode reason to believe that he is her great-grandson.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't go there immediately. Instead, the doctor takes her to the end of the universe, which is where he found Danny – or found Orson. It turns out Orson was from the early 2100s in an early time shot. They were trying to shoot him into next week, and they accidentally overshot and landed him at the end of the universe on the last planet of all, and where he's been stranded for 6 months. So now he wants to get taken back to his own time, to his own family, and the doctor agrees to that, but he says – the TARDIS needs to recharge, and we should be able to go by the morning. And this is something, of course, we've never had before. The TARDIS has never had to recharge in this way. So it seems that the Doctor deliberately wants to stay at the end of the universe to test his theory that there are these invisible companions, because now that there's only the last man in the universe, they might reveal themselves. And so he insists on testing this, and it does seem that there's something banging on the outside of the time capsule trying to get in, and he lets it in, but we don't exactly see what it was. Once again, we don't know, was this something real? Was it just air pressure, or was it a creature? We don't really know. He gets knocked out. And back in the TARDIS, now whatever it is outside is banging on the TARDIS and is jolting it around. And so Clara re-plugs herself into the telepathic interface and attempts an emergency takeoff. And when we land, we're in a very dark space. We're in a barn. And she finds a child. She alone goes outside and finds a child crying on a bed under a blanket. And it's a male child's voice. So at first she thinks it's Danny. But when he doesn't respond, she asks if it's Orson, and it doesn't respond. And then a man and a woman enter the barn. We don't see them very clearly, but we overhear their conversation. And to avoid being seen, Clara hides under the bed. As she's hiding under there, she hears them talking about the boy and how he is out here. He's all alone. He doesn't want to let other children see how afraid he is. The man comments that he needs to stop crying because there's not going to be any crying in the army. The woman says, well, he doesn't want to join the army. And the man says, well, he's certainly not going to make it through the academy. He'll never be a Time Lord. And suddenly we realize this is the very first Doctor as a child. And so Clara realizes that the man and woman go away, and she's debating what to do when the doctor wakes up inside the TARDIS and calls out for her. The young doctor hears that and says, "Who's there?" and gets up and stands on the floor beside his bed. And at that point, to stop him from heading into the TARDIS, Clara reaches out and grabs his leg, thus giving him the dream of having something under the bed and then grabbing his leg, just like everybody else in the universe. She's just fulfilled that. And she tells him, "This is just a dream. Please lay down and just go back to sleep." And he does. She then returns to the TARDIS and says that, you know, maybe there is or isn't something outside or under the bed or in the dark, but maybe it's just that the big bad Time Lord didn't want to admit he's afraid of the dark. And we then get a montage where they take off. We see Orson being reunited with his family. We see her going back to the 21st century and having her first kiss with Danny Pink. And we see the doctor underlining the word "listen" on a chalkboard in the TARDIS. And as all these visuals are playing out, we hear Clara giving the young doctor kind of a reprise of the speech about fear that he gave to the young Danny about how fear is a superpower. It can make you better. She adds to it, though, says it can make you kinder. And she tells the young doctor, "There's going to be a day when you're going to return to this barn and you're going to be very afraid indeed." And she's realized what it is. It's the barn from the time of the war doctor, where he was going to set off the moment and end the time war. And we see file footage of John Hurt coming back to that very same barn as an adult.
Right.
And so she's realized, you know, exactly where she is, and she encourages the doctor to not worry about the fact he's afraid or that he's always going to be afraid, that can actually be a good thing. And she gives him the Dan the Soldier Man doll as a reminder of the leader so strong he doesn't even need a gun.
Exactly. And everything returns back to normal. Thank you so much. That's a great recap. What's your general assessment of this episode?
Me? I liked it a ton. I didn't like the previous Robot of Sherwood. I gave that one a 4. Mm-hmm. This one I would give an 8, maybe even a 9.
Wow. What about you, Dom?
I really liked this one, too. I really enjoyed the doctor in this. He was different. He wasn't as cranky as in the previous two. He was intense, which I really enjoyed. Clara continues to sort of lead the narrative, which I find very interesting. A lot of fans online are talking about that too. How Clara, it's almost the Clara show as opposed to the Doctor. I really enjoyed it. There were hints in this of other episodes we've seen in previous seasons. And I'd say again, this is going to sound like a broken record, but again, I'd give this an 8 and maybe even a 9. It was really good. Couple of little holes we can talk about. A couple of things were left open for me or unclear. So, but we can talk about that as we go through the episode.
Yeah, I like this one a lot as well, especially considering how much they did with so little. As I mentioned in my introduction, it's actually a bit of a low-budget episode. You don't see a monster. There are a few special effects. I mean, they built the set of the space station at the end of the universe, and then there's a bit of wind, et cetera, but no, you know, CGI monsters or anything. It's all done with sound, and it's evoking things. Even the special effect of the monster, we still don't know exactly what that was, in the room of young Rupert, is just basically probably a child with a blanket over its head. So it's very low budget, but so effective. And they did so... The storytelling was so good. I also liked the editing. There was a lot of out-of-sequence mm-hmm. editing, where you saw... I remember the date night, where you first see her reaction and you already gather that this didn't really end up well. And then you switch back to the actual, you know, conversation at the table, and then you switch back to her apartment. And they do that a lot. And
they did that before when they first introduced Danny Pink, too, because we saw his initial interaction with Clara, and then we would see they cut forward to him looking really disappointed.
Right.
And then we got flashbacks to the different ways he blew it with her. And we see basically the same thing from her perspective in this episode.
And it adds comedic timing, but it's also almost subliminally kind of telling you this is going to end. This is not going to end well. It's doomed from the get go, and I love it the way in which they portray the development of this relationship between the two. They're not mm-hmm. really a perfect match from the get go, which makes it a lot more interesting.
Yes,
but I agree with you, Dom. This was very much the Doctor is still almost a child. He is following the lead of Sarah, Clara, apologies. And Clara has the best lines. And there are some fantastic one-liners. Sometimes I had to pause and rewind just to catch them all because there were so many great little moments in this. The best moment in this entire episode to me was when Clara tells the Doctor, "Sit."
Yes.
And he obeys. I normally don't take orders. Well, he does.
Do as you're told. Yes. Yeah.
I got to say, my favorite moment was when they're in the time ship and the lights change. And she says, "Do you have your own mood lighting? Because, frankly, the accent's enough." And he does like a triple take with her on that. I thought that was hysterical. I had to pause it there because that was so great.
Oh, and his nasty comments on her looks. That she was fat when she was young. And why do you need so many mirrors? Did you take your makeup off? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they seem to be implying this doctor doesn't have a firm grasp on human beauty because Clara is obviously drop-dead gorgeous.
But he doesn't see
it. But he's constantly running her down the way she's put on her makeup and stuff like that.
You're all eyes. Your face is too wide. No wonder you need three mirrors.
That is one thing that I've been – I was interested to see them comment on because, you know, sometimes they'll talk about the different physical features of the doctors. Mm-hmm. And like Matt Smith was known for having an amazing chin.
Yes.
And personally, I didn't really – I mean, I would hear them talk about that, but it didn't look so amazing to me. I guess I just don't think in those terms. Mm-hmm. But I did think Clara's face looks really wide. I mean, she's really cute, but her face also does look really wide to
me. Yes. She's got big, big eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's.
I liked it when he ordered her to get her eyes under control.
Yes. They're all over the place. He's still a bit of a fish out of the water. And it's probably because he's still a new doctor. But it's pretty unique. And it's very believable. The acting is just, to me, it's Capaldi is a fantastic doctor right from the get-go.
You know who this doctor reminds me of so much more than any of the previous ones I've seen, but this doctor reminds me of Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang Theory, who mm-hmm. is socially awkward, says the most horrible things to people and doesn't mean anything by it, but just does, mm-hmm. is absolutely brilliant, going off on these theories and tangents. I mean, this is the Sheldon Cooper as an older man. I mean, this is it's actually kind of amazing when you think about it how much alike these characters are. I would love to see someone write some fan fiction that brings them together. It would, if done well, it could be the most amazing thing ever.
You know, you can even imagine some of the lines in this episode being said by Sheldon, like the line about. When Clara learns that Orson Pink's name is Orson Pink, the doctor says, "Yeah, I laugh too." And you can imagine Sheldon saying that. Or, have you seen the size of your brains? They're hilarious. You can imagine Sheldon saying that too.
Exactly.
Steve in the chat room says it's a bit like Strax as well, who is always unable to see the beauty of human beings, but at least the doctor can tell she's a girl.
Yes. I like the fact that Strax can't tell males from females, especially when they're young.
Yes.
Yeah. One thing that this episode, you commented on the fact that it doesn't have a lot of special effects, and uh-huh. That's absolutely right. It's very character driven. And it reminds me in that way of another what's considered one of the best Stephen Moffat episodes ever, which was Blink. That's the one that introduced the Weeping Angels.
Oh, and also one of the classic ones.
Yeah, there are basically no special effects or no real big flashy ones in that either. And you had a story about being really afraid of statues that can't move if you're looking at them. And in this one, we have something similar where we're being really afraid of the ultimate hiders, which is kind of in a way what the Weeping Angels were. Their ability to turn into statues was a self-defense mechanism. And here we have kind of the same thing where you're not looking at the thing and it moves and you're afraid of it.
And it's something that we can all relate to because we've had those fears as children. And I would like to ask you, Dom, you still have young children, and this whole monster under the bed, is that still, you know, something, is that still a thing for kids nowadays?
Well, the kids do still, my kids, and especially my son, Ben, who's now five now, he has had this tendency to have nightmares, and I never knew where it came from. And from a Catholic context, we've given him a pillowcase with Saint Michael on it, and Saint Michael is one of his favorite saints. And we have pictures on the wall. We have Saint Benedict, his patron saint.
He's like Soldier Dan.
Exactly. Well, exactly. And we've helped, tried to help him overcome these. But of all the kids, he's the one who's most sensitive to these types of nightmares and fears, and still wakes up with bad dreams. Kids, they see the dark and they imagine something in it, and they hear a noise and they imagine something. I remember being a kid in the same way. We had a dark hallway in our house and having to go up that hallway at night to bed and hearing the creaks of the house settling. My parents had put an addition on the house, so the house for years would make these noises of the settling, and it would just, your imagination would take you. And everybody has had that fear of something under the bed or something in the closet or the fear of the dark. And that's one of the things that Moffat is so good at, is taking something so basic, so part of the human psyche, and really drawing it out and really freaking you out about it. You don't have to have slavering monsters jumping out at you to scare you. It's just your imagination. And I think that was the big theme here, is nothing about this story ever definitively said whether there was something there or there wasn't. There were things that happened, and you can explain them either way. And so it's your imagination. It was just your imagination, maybe. And that's what's great about it.
And what was so great was the and very relatable was the whole debate between, the rational approach. It's probably this or that. There's probably a perfectly normal explanation for all of this.
It's probably a lot.
Yeah. And then you use the word probably a lot. And then immediately afterward, it continues like, what was that? There was, we're safe here, right? And then she answers, probably. And it's the whole tension between fear and rationality. And, well, it suggests everything so well. They did this, by the way, in a very effective way with a lot of the sound design. They got this idea, or Moffat got this idea while talking with, I think, one of the producers. And he was asked the question, what could we do with sound? And that kind of triggered him, and he started thinking about the plot, working out a plot line of an episode in which you would never see the monster or the creature. You would just hear sounds, hence the title Listen. And the sound engineer tells in they always have this behind the scenes segment on the website of the BBC, but he explains that he deliberately used mechanical sounds in that space station at the end of the universe. So he would use the hissing of pipes and steam, but then he would also use animal sounds, barely audible, and they're just underneath the soundtrack with the mechanical sound. So that subconsciously, you start to doubt as well, what did I just hear? Was that just a mechanical sound, or was there something else hidden in that sound? And it just works. Because there were moments where I was like, ooh, that is genuinely scary.
One of the things that I thought was very interesting about this episode, connected with the whole speech that we get twice about how fear can be a good thing, is there's something kind of metatextual going on there, because Doctor Who in England is known, I mean, it's proverbial for having children hiding behind the couch, for being really scary. Mm-hmm. And back during the 1970s, during the time of the fourth Doctor, Tom Baker, and even earlier than that, there was a campaign that was led against Doctor Who in England for being too scary for children. Mm. And in particular, there was a woman named Mary Whitehouse, who was kind of a crusading child protector, who thought that a lot of the content in Doctor Who was just way over the top scary and it just wasn't appropriate for children. But nevertheless, the series was hugely successful. And to me, this seemed to be kind of an answer to Mary Whitehouse and other critics of actually fear can be a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's not something mm-hmm. that's to be avoided at all costs, even for children.
True.
And they could have carried it further than they did. It would have been harder to do without seeming to just be preaching. But actually, fear is a part of life, and there's a role for horror fiction, because what horror fiction does is it allows us to have an experience of fear and learn to control it in a safe environment.
Yes.
Because, where we're not really under threat. And in the real world, we're going to be encountering fearful situations where we will need to be able to control our fear, and the danger is real. And so God has built it into us a desire to – and a way of having fun with horror and with thrills and roller coasters and ghost stories and all of these things, where we can experience these emotions and learn how to control ourselves despite these emotions in a safe environment, so that when we're in a really dangerous environment, we'll know how to control those same emotions.
A very good point. I think that's true for a lot of the stories, going to the movie theater, playing video games. It's all like helping you to step out of your day-to-day life, experience something very often in a heightened way, exaggerated, but it's safe. And then you go through that, you learn, you experience, you grow, and then you step back into your normal life again. In a way, liturgy is a bit like that, where you step out of your day-to-day life. On Sunday morning, you go to church and you experience something that is way, you know, out of the ordinary, with symbolism, with songs and music that is so different from the stuff that you would listen to or experience during the week. But it literally elevates you to another plane, and you hear stories that make you think, and then after that, you return to your life and you're hopefully also enriched. That is, if you didn't fall asleep during the homily.
You know, you even see this in other areas, including in other species. Like if you've ever watched puppies or kittens play fighting, mm-hmm. you know, that's setting them up for the fights that they'll have to engage in as adult dogs and cats. But they find it fun because, I mean, they need to find it fun in order to engage in that kind of play. But they're not really trying to hurt each other. So it's, again, this kind of same sort of safe, fun learning experience about what will later be a dangerous for real situation. And it just struck me at the spur of the moment, too, talking about movies. Romance movies play the same function in some way. They kind of give people a heightened sense of how to do courtship. Mm-hmm. And then people eventually will court for real.
Yeah, it depends, of course, on the content of the movie or the video game or the book, whether it will help you or not, whether you will actually learn something from it or not. Because I do remember episodes of Doctor Who that I watched as a child with Tom Baker, and that really made me super afraid, and it didn't help me at all to cope with those fears. It just heightened them, you know. I never thought of Daleks, and then all of a sudden I was imagining that they would be in my room, and if I would switch on the light, they would be standing there in the corner, you know, yelling, "Exterminate!"
Actually, I thought, when I was a child, I thought I could see a slee stack in my closet at night, so I was really scared of that slee stack.
Oh, boy. But, no, I think that's why a lot of people loved this episode, because it was... You know, you're watching the fear of someone else, and that is actually a lot of fun, to see that even the doctor can be afraid. Mm-hmm. And I totally didn't expect the twist that it was such a substantial part of his younger years. And I love the whole, you know, going back to early times of the Doctor. It was what they call, actually, the people in production call this a typical Moffat loop. And there's a very short part of the extra behind the scenes episode on the website of the BBC that I would like to play about this, because it might set us up for a bit of a conversation about the young Time Lord.
In this episode, we also got an unexpected surprise, a very rare glimpse into the Doctor's life.
She ends up in the Doctor's childhood mistakenly, and then sees him as a child and speaks to him and tells him these words that she's already heard from the Doctor. So it's kind of one of these, we call it a Moffat loop. It's a Moffat loop that happens again.
And the director, well, he was thrilled to be part of such a significant moment in Doctor Who history.
When I realised that the little boy in the bed was actually the young Doctor, I had a shiver down my spine straight away. Directing that moment and knowing that Doctor Who fans everywhere are just going to be exploding with amazement that we've got the youngest Doctor ever on the show, that was my moment.
This was a rare glimpse, because even though we've been travelling with the Doctor for over 50 years now, we still know surprisingly little about his early life. We know he attended the Academy on Gallifrey, where he had at least two tutors. Verusa, this strict teacher, would later become the schemer in search of immortality and power. Then we have Asmael, one of the Doctor's favourites, who would ultimately sacrifice himself to stop the evil Mestor. The Doctor, or Theta Sigma as he was informally known back then, did graduate from the Academy, but not exactly with flying colours. According to his old companion Romana, he scraped through with 51% on his second attempt. Maybe he was distracted from his studies by his friends. After all, they did include the Master. After that, all we know is that he got tired of watching the universe pass him by. So, going against the strict policy of non-interference, he stole a TARDIS and set off to travel throughout time and space.
And that's what we know about about the young Doctor. I was intrigued by hearing what I assume are his parents or caretakers.
I think they're caretakers. They deliberately leave that question open. Mm-hmm. But there's a line where they tell him you don't have to be alone. You can come back in and be with the other boys, and that sounded to me, although it could be that he could have more than one brother, it sounded to me more like the typical British experience of having, at least in certain classes of society, sending your children off to a single-sex boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
And so my guess is that they were the caretakers of that boarding school, although they don't really establish it one way or another.
And he seems to be sleeping, near a haystack or in a kind of a farm setting. Now, of course, that could have been part of the premises. I don't know.
Exactly. A school like that might have stables, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it all seems so very even the clothing that we saw of the care of these the man and the woman who came in, it seemed old, like medieval even, or at least 18th century of some sort. This was an old place. And it makes me wonder, so is Gallifrey – Is that sort of the trend in Gallifrey? This is sort of an old fashion, or is there something more that's being said about the Doctor's origins that maybe the origin? I don't know. It's very strange. That and the whole the bigger question here is we've been told that Gallifrey is now in another universe. So and yes, the Doctor took the safeguards off that, and that's what ended them up at the end of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So would the loss of those safeguards allow them to then travel to this inaccessible place to get to Gallifrey?
It's the past of Gallifrey. Yeah. So in a way, that wouldn't be in a different universe. It's just a present and a future Gallifrey that is part of a different dimension. But I suppose that the past is still accessible by the TARDIS.
Perhaps, because the whole of Gallifrey was time-locked from the universe.
Oh.
And so it looks like they may have crossed that time lock because of the safeties being off. And that may be why, at least the real-world explanation for why Clara refuses to let the Doctor see where they've landed.
Hmm.
Because if he realized we're on Gallifrey, that would have a revolutionizing effect on his desire to get back to Gallifrey and reestablish contact.
We really don't know exactly what happens if you get these loops, and there have been other episodes where even the Doctor and his companion at the time were meeting their counterparts in the future or in the past, and nothing happened. And there's an episode in which there's a guy who touches his former self, and that creates a huge energy surge. So it's still uncertain what happens. I guess it's the same situation as in Back to the Future, where you know, you never know. It might, the universe might explode, or nothing might actually happen. Yeah.
They're inconsistent about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, Father, you mentioned companions, and that's I kind of wanted to bring that up in this show today, because you know that this seems to be a fundamental aspect of the personality of the Doctor. You know, he. One of the things we've always known about him is he always seeks out companions. It's not good for the Doctor to travel alone.
Yeah.
Maybe we've seen the reason why that you know, he talks about them in the beginning as, you know, what if every single living being has a companion? And yeah. And in fact, he has provided himself with a companion, maybe because he's been so afraid of being alone. That this fear of being alone with perhaps this hidden creature has driven him in so many ways to be who he is, to do what he has done. You know, that this drive to never be by yourself, to drive to always have a companion, is motivated by this fear, this primal fear from childhood. It seems to be, you know, an interesting motivator for him.
It could be that, but also, and that's also something that we learn about his younger self, is that he was already, you know, socially a bit of a loner, or, you know, it didn't blend in well with the other kids. And so there's that fear of being alone and suffering of the fact of, you know, crying there by yourself. You don't want to show the others. You have to be someone else, or portray to be someone else, even though you're just afraid and you're not certain. So there's that ambiguity. But then there is also this the appearance of Clara. So one of his future companions at that moment might have given him the idea to seek a companion, not knowing that his, you know, entire adventure started with, you know, one of his future companions actually being under the bed.
I like how that connected with the previous thing they've established about Clara too, about how she appears all along his timeline.
Yes. Yeah, true. She's consistently been popping up everywhere. The impossible girl. Well, there, right. She did it again.
Speaking of this companion bit, just to throw one last bit in there to kind of stir the pot. Back in 1963, in the episode An Unearthly Child, the first Doctor says the line, "Fear makes companions of us all." And
yes.
that comes up, and that was part of what Clara, in fact, says near the end there, that you know, fear is a constant companion, always there.
Yeah, it actually ends with, "It makes companions of us all."
Right.
There are several callbacks to previous lines from other Doctors. In this episode, when the Doctor kind of startles awake towards the end, he says, "Santarin's trying to subvert the history of the universe." That's the first thing that Tom Baker said when he became the Doctor.
Oh.
And it's a callback to an adventure that the third Doctor had. So they had quite a number of those little references going back and forth in this episode.
Fascinating. What,
one thing kind of a larger nature that you touched on, with this being kind of a rare glimpse into the Doctor's childhood, there's a reason for that those glimpses are so rare, mm-hmm. into the Doctor's past. It's because they don't want to demythologize him. You know, part of the appeal of the Doctor is he's this mystery figure that we don't really know a lot about. And over 50 years, they've managed to keep from telling us very much about his past in order to sustain that mystery. In fact, for the first two Doctors, or the first 6 years of the show, we didn't even know what his people were called. They told us in the first episode that he was from another planet and another century, and that's it. And they didn't say whether he was an alien. They didn't establish the two hearts. We didn't know what the Time Lords were.
Yeah.
And so we went through 6 years of Doctor Who not knowing any of that. And then the first time we learned the word Time Lord was in the final story of the second Doctor. It was a 10-part story called The War Games. And at the end of the story, Patrick Troughton's second Doctor had to call in his own people to solve the problem. And that was the first time that we ever heard the word Time Lord. It was 6 years into the series. And so they've, in order to preserve the mystery, they've only given us little dribs and drabs. And so they'll never give us, you know, a full accounting of everything about the Doctor's history. But that's what makes little glimpses like this one to the Doctor's childhood so special and so rare.
It's what struck me when I watched the pilot episode for the entire series. You have the blog about, you know, kind of reviewing all these old episodes from the 60s one by one.
Let's watch Doctor Who. Yeah.
And so I watched the, and I think the pilot actually was never aired. And it's so funny to see the first, and it was reshot, I think. But in that pilot, he's just an old guy, cranky, and he seems to be the grandfather of this girl who is probably just his companion that he picked up. But it's, there's still so much mystery surrounding this guy, and just realizing while watching that everything still had to be written, that they probably didn't even know at the time that he would turn into this Time Lord, and that the sound of the thumping sound of the opening tune actually was the rhythm of his heart. That's all stuff that they made up later to fill in all these blanks. It's fascinating to go back in time and rewatch those early episodes. Like, I totally understand why you started doing that, because it's compulsive watching.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see how the series evolved.
And immediately also, which made me laugh, in that very first pilot episode, you see the round things inside the cardboard TARDIS set.
Yeah, they've given a name to those. Those are called roundels.
Roundels.
The Doctor has just taken to referring to them as round things.
What did y'all think of that psychic interface that was clearly needed to go to these special places? It's a kind of a relational way to navigate the TARDIS. I don't remember having ever seen that type of navigation. Is it something that harkens back to earlier incarnations of the TARDIS or the Doctor?
They've talked about the TARDIS having a telepathic matrix or telepathic circuits, but they've never shown us that interface for them.
I thought they were pretty cool. They reminded me a bit of, if you've seen the reimagined, rebooted Battlestar Galactica series. At one point,
yes.
I think it was in season 4, we go inside the Cylon ship.
And they're putting their fingers in water.
Yeah, they have this colored water, and it's kind of scary. You have to put your hands in it, and it's a way to operate the whole ship.
In this, it looks like Clara's sticking her fingers into the folds of a brain.
Yeah.
And I like how the Doctor says, if anything bites, let it.
Oh, gosh. That's one of those fears. You know, you put your hand in something and you don't know exactly what's on the other end. Oh, it's brilliant. And she seems to be unafraid of anything. She just does it. And even when the Doctor is knocked out, she just takes charge and navigates the TARDIS out of harm's way. Which brings me to another question. So they use that interface to go to the end of the universe, this most remote planet. I remember having seen in previous seasons the TARDIS travel to these extremities of time of the universe, to the early beginning and to the last day of the universe. And was this something that we've seen before? Is this a particular, you know, is this part of the overall saga of or the universe building that they did in previous years?
No, this is the last. This is the last planet left in the universe. And he says it pretty specifically that the TARDIS is never supposed to go there, and he'd never been. I mean, they've been far in the future. They've been to the end of the planet Earth. They've been to the end of other, you know, galaxies.
The end of time, even.
Right. Well, they've never been to the last place with no one left in the universe but themselves. And that's unique to this episode, I think.
Yeah, I don't think they've ever gone quite this far. They have gone to similarly far places. There's an episode back during the David Tennant era called Utopia, where they go to an extreme point in the future. But I don't think it's quite this far. And in that instance, they meet the very last human beings, or what seem to be the last human beings. And they also meet the Master, who who is reintroduced at that point, being played for that moment by Derek Jacobi.
I thought for, you know, being the last planet in the universe, it looked a bit mundane. It was almost like a badly rendered kind of Martian type of landscape. And then there happens to be an Earth ship as well. How convenient.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, there's a little scientific stuff you can pick on here. When you're talking about the last planet in the universe, well, it's got a sun.
Yeah, clearly.
Does it mean the last planet that could be habitable or what? Because surely there would be lots of dead planets drifting around everywhere, even without suns. I mean, we have those now. Rogue planets exist. Mm-hmm. So when he talks about the last planet, I don't think they can mean literally the last planet to exist unless we're so far in the future that proton decay has occurred and everything's just disintegrated. But that doesn't seem to be what they're doing here because this planet has a sun. So yeah. I think there's a little something you could pick on there if you wanted.
But anyway, it was, of course, to explain that, you know, everything had to be gone. So there's no place for these creatures, if they do exist, to hide anymore. So if they are anywhere, they have to be on this planet, right? Because there is no other place to hide, which is harkening back to the beginning of the episode, this whole monologue of the Doctor. You know, what if there is, you know, why is there no creature that's perfect at hiding, etc. By the way, I love that whole, you know, opening. It was very enigmatic. And you see the Doctor, mm-hmm. you know, sitting on top of the TARDIS, and you hear all these clicking sounds of the these tiny little sounds that the TARDIS makes. And then later on, it's been referred to as all these tiny little ticking sounds that you hear in the dark, and that could make you afraid. It's very well constructed, this episode.
I think that also played into the question of why the Doctor travels with companions, because here we see him being alone and he goes crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and he might just be afraid. That's why he's talking to himself. It's also, and he's writing on the blackboard. It's all, I think, tricks to control the fear. You know, start writing it down. He opens books. It's all a way to grasp, you know, the situation that instills so much irrational fear and try to fill that void with rationality. It's even when he talks about, they're looking outside the window in the room of Rupert, young Rupert Pink. And they're staring outside and I think it's the Doctor who says, yeah, it's so dark outside, or it might be Clara, and then the Doctor says, well, you know what, if it weren't for the dark, we would never see the light of the stars. And again, it's it's nice, but it's, I think, poetry to push away the fear. there's a reason for the darkness.
Yeah, sorry, I wanted to bring up something like the why. You kind of maybe have a conversation, but why was this story connected to the Rupert Danny Clara story? What was the connection? I don't think it's accidental. There's a connection.
Oh, absolutely.
Is it that Danny and Clara, or the universal human condition, to be afraid of being alone, and that's why they're drawn to one another? I mean, I think there's something to be said for this, but not to mention the fact that Clara just seems to be this girl. It doesn't seem to be limited to the Doctor, but who ends up in the lives of throughout the lifetime of the various men in her life somehow.
I don't know. There's clearly this tension. It's a classic love triangle almost, or at least there's a rivalry between the Doctor and Danny Pink, because Clara is now attracted to, you know, to Dan, but at the same time the Doctor needs a companion. And it's almost that I'm thinking, you know, could he be talking down to her about her appearance and her being fat and not wearing makeup? Because it's also a way to kind of already prepare him for the disappointment or the new loneliness that will occur, perhaps, if she takes off with Danny.
From the Doctor's perspective, that's interesting. From Clara's perspective, I think that unlike some prior companions, I mean, she has unlike any prior companion, she has not moved on to the TARDIS. And she's maintaining a separate personal life. She's not just going gallivanting around the universe with him. And she's showing a lot more independence of the Doctor than previous companions have. And so I think that, you know, we're clearly going to build to a crisis at some point where she makes a choice between the Doctor and a regular life, and she's going to choose the regular life. But she'll be able to make that transition better than some previous companions have because of her greater degree of independence. I think before we get to that point, though, I think Danny's likely to at least – she's going to try to include Danny as a companion, and it'll be interesting to see whether the Doctor accepts him, because in the very second episode of this series, we saw the Doctor refuse a companion on the grounds that that companion was a soldier.
Yeah.
And Danny is a soldier. And you notice in this episode, we have all that stuff where Danny is very defensive about the fact he was a soldier. And it's not all about killing people. He dug 26 wells and saved villages that would have died of thirst. And I think they're including that information to kind of set up the dynamic that we're eventually going to have to face of will the Doctor accept him as a companion or not, given the fact that he's a soldier.
Well, and the irony is that it is actually the Doctor who probably is the cause of him becoming a soldier, because he gives the boy a beautiful dream about being Dan the soldier.
And then, I want that dad skill.
Yeah.
That would be a nice dad skill.
Must be very convenient.
Once upon a time, the end.
Well, and the Doctor's had a chance to use it before, given that, I mean, on the premise, which I accept, which is that Susan really was his granddaughter. So he's had children before on that. And he said he's had children before. And if we take him at his word, then he would have been able to use that dad skill.
And there, of course, is also this, and it can be a coincidence, a mention of the boy being afraid to enter the army in this discussion when he's crying under the bed sheets. And these two, you know, parental figures are like, well, he'll never be able to join the army. So there's clearly a trauma there, or a fear of the army, and perhaps being in the vicinity of soldiers will, you know, trigger that fear again. And that might be why he's so, you know, repulsed by anything that has to do with armies. It could also be because of all his enemies. They all are, you know, usually they're not solo enemies. They're always teaming up in big armies, whether it be, you know, the Daleks or other mechanical man. It's always these big armies.
And the figure of Dan the Soldier Man, the plastic toy, the leader who is so tough he doesn't even need a gun, that clearly foreshadows the Doctor's own future as a traveling hero who doesn't use a gun.
Yeah. He's got a sonic screwdriver and a spoon. That's about it.
We mentioned this in a previous podcast, but this aversion to soldiers seems to be a unique quirk, not necessarily unique to this Doctor, but it's stronger in this Doctor than we've seen it previously. And in fact, the third Doctor actually worked for the military for basically almost his entire incarnation. And so the Doctor hasn't always been as averse to soldiers as he is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's clearly something that happens when you regenerate. There's also a kind of a reconfiguration of your sensibilities and perhaps memories that get shaken up a little bit as well.
Yes.
There was a very interesting visual reference to an earlier episode when Clara sees I assume it's her future, you know, grandson Orson Pink in his spacesuit, and she first thinks that it's the Doctor, and it the spacesuit and suit itself is very similar to one that was used in an episode called The Impossible Planet, and I see a photo here of that episode, and it indeed looks exactly the same. Actually, it might just be the same prop that they reused.
It's surprising in television and in Hollywood how often you'll see props like that in science fiction getting reused in one franchise and then another.
Yeah. But it's again, it's funny how they
– Oh, you know, the same suit, I bet, shows up in Waters of Mars, where the Doctor is alone on Mars. He wears another orange spacesuit like that.
And there's also a spacesuit in Hyde, the episode Hyde of Series 7, which was a bit – looked similar. So, yeah, they're different occurrences of that. But I like it that probably the idea was we need a space suit. Oh, we still have the one that we used in that episode. Oh, we'll just add a line and just, you know, use it for the story purposes. And it's just very creative.
They probably wanted to do that specifically in order to fake out previous Doctor Who fans who had seen those episodes make them think like Clara, this is the Doctor crashing her date.
Yeah, who knows?
You know, speaking of elements coming back from other episodes, I mean, I felt like there were a couple of things that just kept coming up in this episode. Like, you know, the we've seen creatures who hide in the, you know, hide when we're not looking for them, when we don't see them. That's the silence. And we've seen a creature that bangs around on the outside of a hull of a spaceship or a ship in a hostile environment. That's the creature that from Midnight. You know, it's interesting how they kind of recycling sounds like a bad thing, but they've recycled some of these ideas from other episodes, and I'm trying to figure out. There's just a couple of things about this episode I couldn't figure out. I couldn't understand where Moffat was coming from, what he intended by it, and those were a couple of those factors.
You've got the don't look around. That was clearly taken from The Girl in the Fireplace with the clockwork droids. That's under the girl's bed. And then he says the same thing. Don't look around. And
there's clearly some resonance with the silence and with the weeping angels. So Moffat seems to at least be recycling some of the same elements. But he paid them off in a way that I like this time. One thing, and I guess I accept it because I understand it conceptually now, that it's deliberately ambiguous about whether there are such creatures as are being postulated in this episode, the super hiders or whatever you want to call them. But at the time on my first watch, I've watched it twice, and on the time of my first watching, this was an element that I found a little unsatisfying, that I wanted more of a payoff on that question, because they slap that question, you know, right up front and make it the central organizing theme of this episode, and then they never answer it. And I love all the stuff they do with the characters in this episode. This is where I think Doctor Who is at its best, when it's dealing with characters rather than monsters. But still, I kind of wanted some more payoff than I got on my first watch through.
What exactly did you want the payoff to be then?
I wanted to learn definitively that there are such things.
Okay.
And not necessarily see one, because they need to preserve mystery around them. But given that the whole episode is organized around the question of, do these things exist? And the presumptive answer on Doctor Who is going to be, yes, there are such things. Then I wanted to see that established.
Yeah, I think they definitely deliberately didn't want to break that ambiguity, because that's the strength. It's the tension between the two. Is it real? Is it not? Is it all rational, or does fear have a place? My first association when I watched this episode was guardian angels. It's a very, very, you know, important concept in the Catholic tradition. Is like these angels, these pure spirits that are tasked with, you know, being basically an invisible companion for human beings. And we don't know much about them, even theologically. Right. There's not much that we can say about them, but it's been a consistent element, I think, of Catholic spirituality, that there are such things as guardian angels.
True, though then there are also the other not-so-nice ones, too.
The little devils that whisper in your ear. And I don't know if that was in the back of, you know, their minds when they wrote this episode, but it was definitely in my mind.
I think, I don't know whether the guardian angels were, but I think that you can see that same kind of ambiguity in the proposed hiding creatures in this episode. If they're there, what would they do? Would they be good or bad? Mm-hmm. Just like guardian angels and demons, some are good, some are bad. But there is this kind of hidden realm of additional intelligent beings there that we can't directly perceive.
Yeah. Well, and that whole question of, you know, these invisible companions, do you have to fear them or not, is a little bit also presented as a metaphor of the emotional struggle of this new doctor, Capaldi's doctor, with intimacy. You know, I'm not the hugging kind. I'm against the hugging. Yep. He's, he always has this, I can't live without these companions, without Clara, but don't come too close. Because, you know, it also scares the heck out of me.
I think that, which I really like, that he's opposed to hugging, but Clara hugs him anyway. I think that also fits with Dom's theory of the 12th Doctor as Sheldon Cooper, because you can imagine Sheldon Cooper doing exactly the same thing. One difference between this Doctor and Sheldon Cooper, though, is because of their age difference. Sheldon can sometimes, just in his vocal inflections, he comes across kind of as a petulant child or teenager. Mm-hmm. And this doctor, because he's more mature, even though the line could be the same, his inflection is different and more mature. But I think Dom's really onto something there with Peter Capaldi as Sheldon Cooper.
Well, it's definitely a part for a big part the same audience that watches both shows, so
yeah,
it won't be lost on them. Next week, the episode is I actually don't know what it's called. It's Time Heist. And before we wrap things up, let me play the sound of the trailer.
This is the Bank of Carol Braxos.
Picture the thing you want most in the universe. Decide how badly you want it.
We're actually going to do it. Rob the bank.
If we don't, we die.
We must locate them.
What is that?
I don't know. Hate not knowing.
Are you hungry, boy?
The bank is now open.
Well, this episode, number four, called Listen, might have been a low-budget episode with not too many complicated sets and aliens. This new episode seems to be the opposite of that, because we see some amazing-looking sets and some pretty cool creatures as well. So I'm looking forward to it. It also, I've got the feeling that this the episode five will be a little bit more part of the overall plot line. Whereas my intuition for the episode Listen was that it would just be, you know, a kind of an inconsequential in-between episode. And the fact that it was pretty low budget kind of makes me think that, yes, it was. Although it does really help build the character of Capaldi's Doctor. So in that respect, it was important for the continuity. But
I suspect in the next episode we're going to get to see Missy or something about the Promised Land again. One of the reasons I say that is the next episode is co-written by Stephen Moffat, and it comes about mid-season. In fact, the next two are, and they come about mid-season, and that's kind of the time in the season story arc that you want to remind people that there is a season story arc.
Absolutely.
And so given that and given his co-writing, I suspect we're going to get some more on the Promised Land and Missy.
I can't wait to talk about that episode and to watch it first, of course, Time Heist. I love heist stories, so I'm already looking forward to all the references to all the heist movies that are out there.
Yeah, as long as the Doctor doesn't have the climax be telling Clara to go over to a 51st century combination lock and do something clever.
Let's wrap up things. Dom, where can people find you on the web?
Well, they can find me at my website. It's betnet.com, BETTNET.com. And, of course, Secrets of Star Wars at SQPN.
Oh, yeah. And there's some new secrets, or some new secrets that we need to talk about, because there are new photos and leaks. Oh, and, oh boy, exciting times for Star Wars fans. What about you, Jimmy? Where can people find more about you and about Doctor Who?
They can find out about Doctor Who on one of my websites, letswatchdoctorwho.com. I got a domain name for it now, so letswatchdoctorwho.com. And then they can also find out more about me at jimmyakin.com.
How often do you update that blog? What's the pace of reviewing those episodes?
For Let's Watch Doctor Who, I haven't updated it in a week or so, but my goal is to kind of do one a week or one every other week, one major Doctor Who story. A lot of these older stories are not single episodes, so I'll have to watch like 3 or even 5 hours worth of material, and I can't do that every single week. but I'm trying to proceed apace.
I can imagine that. It's been a lot of fun. So I've been rewatching these early episodes, reading your blog, and it's just a great companion guide almost for watching these episodes, because that's the downside of watching older episodes. You've got no one to talk to about it. Yeah. It's like these episodes, everybody has seen them. So the Twitter, Facebook, it's all abuzz with the latest, you know, theories and fan exchanges. You don't have that with the previous episodes. And we've already had some requests from listeners that are asking. They're looking, you know, ahead and thinking, what if this season 8 is over? Are you guys going to continue the show? And I was thinking, you know what? We might actually go back in time and do the occasional, you know, fan favorite episode and just talk about these, you know, classic Doctor Who episodes. That could be
or
fun.
Or worst ever.
Worst ever. Yeah. Best ever. Most intriguing one ever. Most low budget. There are so many ways in which we could continue our discussion about Doctor Who. But for the moment, I'm happy to just talk about the new episodes every week. Thanks again for joining me today. You can find SQPN's podcast and the ones that I produce over at the website of the StarQuest Production Network. And that is very simple. SQPN.com. You can find earlier and future episodes of this podcast on the website DoctorWho.sqpn.com. And if you have some time and you want to help us spread the word about this podcast, we would so appreciate it if you could hop in its heart as fly to the iTunes music store and leave us a review or a rating. That definitely helps people find the show, because there are quite a few Doctor Who shows out there, and hopefully this one is unique enough to add to the enjoyment of this great television series. I'm Father Roderick from the Netherlands, signing off for this episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who, and talk to you soon.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.
SQPN. Leading the way in Catholic New Media.